Can you... Me? I think it's a bad... connection. Are you... Bobby, are you there?
What are you doing?
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.
I was pretending we had a bad phone connection because we're recording in person this time for the first time, and I was excited about it.
Yeah, that's cool. So we had a technical problem where our mics weren't working together, but this is almost better because before we were facing each other across the table making eye contact.
Now we're awkwardly staring at a wall sitting next to each other, not making eye contact.
But this is essentially like how you talk to your friends while you're playing video games, you know?
Yes, yes.
So this
exactly.
feels much better. I can be in the room, but like also pretend that you're not here at the same time, I guess.
It feels strange. I don't know if I like this yet.
Anyway, this is the first episode we're doing in person.
Yes.
Before, we have always been doing this remotely.
Clearly our audience is going to be just as excited about that fact as we obviously are.
We got to shut this down, dude. Yeah. This isn't working.
We also hung out for about 3 hours before this today, and I'm worried we talked about everything already that we would want to talk about on the show. So I'm not sure I have any ammunition for the day. So this is the podcast. It's going to be about 10 minutes long. Bye, guys.
Yeah, so we've cleared our first two segments. All my notes I have.
Well, what have you been up to
Ian
lately?
Robot Bit.
What are you doing these days?
I saw Hamilton for the third time.
I saw that on Instagram. And I literally said out loud to my roommate, what the fuck, you seeing Hamilton again?
It's funny, about a year ago, an old work friend... was like, do you want to buy tickets off me? And they were so impossible to get when it came to LA. I'm like, yeah. And I, you know, he only upcharged me by a very small amount. So I was like, this is a steal. And then I won the ticket lottery, which I was entering every day. And then came to Orange County and watched it again. So I didn't think within 1 year, I thought for sure I would not watch Hamilton when it came to LA because it was so hard to get tickets. But now I've watched it 3 times, Ian.
Are you happy about that?
Yes,
are you proud
I am
of yourself?
So happy about it. It's so
good. Are you
so
happy
good.
That you've taken that? I've seen it 0 times, so you've basically taken away a viewing of Hamilton for me, so you could be
yeah.
Happy,
that's
selfish.
That's how that works.
It's zero sum
totally,
game, man.
Totally how it works. Yeah, that one time you tried to buy tickets for Hamilton.
So how was it, Bobby?
It was really good.
Yeah.
It was really good. The Orange County cast is really good, Ian. I don't know what you want me to say. It's amazing.
I want you to feel a little bit of shade.
I don't, because Hamilton is so good. It's that good.
That's such an interesting, unique opinion that I've never heard before.
Yeah, you know what, though? I get, like, that's the one piece of pop culture I'll fight people on if they're just like, yeah, I didn't totally get Hamilton. I think, like, I would just stop smiling and be like, oh, yeah, that's
I pictured you just physically leaping over a table at somebody, and I would pay money to see you physically fight someone who didn't like Hamilton.
I have a Hamilton mug at work, a coffee mug.
Uh-huh,
It's like I got it off of Etsy, or Laura got it for me off of Etsy, I think. Uh-huh. But there are three characters.
Well, wait, let's slow down. Who got it off of Etsy? I want to make sure we get that right.
You know, it was Laura got it for me after I picked it out. But now that I'm thinking about it, it wasn't even Etsy, I don't think.
Bobby,
but
and people
this is,
come to us
this
for,
is a niche,
for credibility.
This is a niche joke, so I won't go into it, but anyone who's seen Hamilton will understand. It has, like, three, you know, revolutionary-era, like, cartoon women snapping their fingers, and then it says, work, work, on the back. And so it just looks like a really weird mug for, like, a nerdy dude like me to have. But I'm so proud of that mug. I'm so happy.
Yeah, I literally don't get the reference.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But it's just...
Hamilton is one that I have wanted to see. So in all honesty, I make fun of you about Hamilton because I know it's near and dear to your heart. But I've been wanting to see it forever. And everyone tells me not to do what I've been doing, which is I've avoided all of the music from it because I want to see it live
first.
That's
good advice.
Oh, everyone's... No, I... Everyone... What's good advice?
To listen to it.
Yeah, so everyone tells me it's really dense and you should
yeah.
pick up on everything beforehand. So I've been meaning to do that. I think it's probably time. But I figured... I mean, oftentimes when I hear of a good musical, my reaction is, cool, I'll see it when they make a movie out of it. Not because I hate theater, I just don't have a lot of opportunities to go. Last big theater production I saw was Book of Mormon, and that was, what, 6 years after that was in Broadway. Oh, yeah. So, you know, I'm definitely behind the times on that stuff.
I think where Hamilton, where you benefit from listening to it ahead of time, is it's so lyrically dense because it's, you know, it's told mostly through rap.
Right.
That you lyrics will fly by you and so much information is being conveyed because it's covering a long stretch of history.
Right.
But it's so good, man. It's really good. I mean, I picked Lin-Manuel Miranda for the first thing we ever did on this
podcast.
That's
true. You definitely did. He is a big fan of West Wing, and he did a... I don't think I talked about this on the show yet. He did a rap for the West Wing Weekly podcast, which I'm a fan of. And it's about the show. It's not about the podcast. It's really, really good. I sent it to you. Did you actually listen to it?
No, I haven't listened to it.
Okay, I mean, it's all just inside jokes about West Wing, so if you haven't seen much West Wing, it probably won't do a ton for you, but I loved it. It was very, very good.
He did a thing 5 million years ago when Barack Obama was president. The cast of Hamilton went to the White House and did some songs, but there's a cabinet battle in the musical, and the cast of Hamilton acted out that cabinet battle, this hip-hop cabinet battle in the West Wing as a scene from the West Wing, and it was really, really great.
I will say I had to look up some stuff from Hamilton because I don't know Hamilton at all, so when you sent me that and said it was cool, I didn't understand what I was seeing at first, but it was cool when I figured out what I was watching. I liked it as well. What else have you been up to?
I there's a new game I've been playing. It's called Pokemon Quest.
You texted me about this the other day. This is a free Switch Pokemon mm-hmm. game, correct?
And it'll soon be coming to iPhone, from what I understand, and Android. But it's basically just a mobile RPG that you don't have to think about.
And you're very proud of the fact that you've been playing this, I can tell from the way you're talking about it right now.
I am. My Squirtle just evolved into a Wartortle, and I keep sending them out on missions, and it's fun.
When I was probably about 12, I was talking to, I think, one of my brothers in the car on a trip somewhere, and I said Blastoise, and my dad said, "That sounds like a venereal disease," and I have never been able to get that out of my head ever since then. Yeah, that's all I got to say about that. So it's good? You like it?
Yeah. Okay. You know, a legit cool thing, oh god, this is like, we're into Pokemon talk now.
Uh-huh.
The cool thing it does at the beginning is, like every Pokemon game, you pick which Pokemon you want to start out with, and it gives you, you know, Squirtle, Charmander, or Bulbasaur, but it also lets you pick Pikachu and Eevee, and that's pretty neat.
I'm really enjoying right now the look on Bobby's face when he talks about these things, because I've never really gotten to see it before, and there's this deep well of shame in your soul that I can see in your eyes right now. I don't think necessarily should be there, but it definitely is anyway.
Just because I want you to play this game so bad, and then when you play it, you're just going to be like, what the fuck, Bobby? This game is stupid.
No, I sincerely am going to download it. I'm as much of a Pokemon geek as you are, although I mostly just... fell off after the original. I played Black and White, some of the other ones, but we both got the news this week that there's a new console Pokemon game coming out, which is a return to Kanto, the original world of Pokemon, and I'm so excited.
Two new console games
coming out. Well, that's true.
No, not even that. There is the Pokemon Go Pikachu and Pokemon Go Eevee ones that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then they also announced that after that, very soon after that, they're going to release another new Pokemon game more in line with, like...
Oh, I thought these were both the same thing. I misunderstood.
I thought so, too. But okay. I guess they're more aimed at, like, a casual kind of fun thing, and they're releasing, like, a legit Pokemon game on Switch.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that, though. That'll be good. All right, are we done talking about Pokemon for the day?
What stupid shit have you been up to?
What have I been up to? So I get very excited, and even though I said on the podcast, you know, take as long as you want, the second Bobby agreed to play Last of Us, I immediately started replaying Last of Us. And since then, I love that game so much that I needed methadone to kind of come down from the high of my favorite game. So I've been playing all of the Uncharted games, which are made by the same company and are similar to, like... They're not similar games in terms of the style or narrative, but you can tell that they were made by the same people. They're kind of mm-hmm. within the same genre. And god damn it, Uncharted is so fun. That's all I have to say about it. I mean, I know I'm not like the first or last person to ever say that, but those games are great.
I've heard that. I need to get around to that.
You played the second one all the way through, right?
I did.
Did you like it?
Not really.
Why? So why? Because I think there's very legitimate reasons not to like Uncharted as well.
I mean, I'm going to toss out the narrative altogether.
That's not fair, because that's what the point of those games are. That's my first thing.
I think the narrative is fine. I don't think it's anything remarkable. I think it's perfectly fine.
I agree. I think that the first three are a little more basic than people remember them to be. Four is very good.
I've heard good things about four.
Four is really complex.
I found the gameplay in two to just not be compelling at all.
I heard somebody once describe 1 through 3 as basically this generation's version of Dragon. What's it called? What's the Donald Bluth game from the '80s? The one that looks like a Disney movie.
It's not Dragon Quest.
I
know which one you're
talking about. Space Ace is the other one. But yeah, there are these games that are basically
Dragon's
a cartoon.
Lair.
Dragon's Lair. Thank you. Yeah. And you have to just hit left at the right exact moment, or hit a button at the exact moment. So it's basically just the original QuickTime game. And I get that about the originals now that I've replayed them. But 4 is really perfect.
I've heard that. And I know I always mention Film Crit Hulk, which I just really enjoy his writing.
I do too. I'm not going to make fun of you about that one. I love him as well.
He wrote a thing about Uncharted 4. And in his preface to talking about how great Uncharted 4 was, he mentioned not being huge fan of the first three Uncharted, and so I should probably give 4 a shot.
4 is doing different things. It also is a different writer, I will say. And Tom Bissell, who I assume you probably know and love as well, helped write 4. Why there's a reference to his critique of the first three games in 4. One of the most famous kind of critiques of the Uncharted games is that you're supposed to be this lovable rogue, and you kill about 2,000 people every time you play one of those games. He's just clearly a mass murderer, because that's like that's how games work. You need something to keep you from,
Uncharted 2 was the first game where I noticed, like, why did I just viciously murder that guard?
Yeah. And Tom Bissell called it ludonarrative dissonance, which is that the way that games work in terms of game theory didn't fit with the narrative they were trying to create. And there's a achievement in 4 where if you kill enough people, the achievement is called ludonarrative dissonance. So I enjoyed that.
Nerd.
Yeah.
Tom Bissell also wrote the Gears of War prequel game.
I never played that.
I haven't either.
Yeah. I was just playing. That's so weird. I was over at a friend's house and I was just playing the first Gears of War again last night. Those games have a lot of testosterone.
Have you ever read, he wrote a book of essays about video games?
I know of it. I have not read it.
And
I've seen some excerpts.
There were really interesting essays I read in that. That's why I mentioned Far Cry 2 a couple weeks ago.
Because
he freaked out about Far Cry 2.
Okay.
He wrote this essay about his addiction to Grand Theft Auto 4. And he mirrored it with, like, his addiction to cocaine at the time. And it was a very interesting thing to read.
That's fascinating. I would love to read that. That sounds great.
And he wrote an essay about Mass Effect 2 that was really interesting too. Okay. Anyway, I recommend his writing. He also co-wrote The Disaster Artist.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
It's him and Greg Sestero.
I thought he was just kind of a critic. I didn't realize. I thought that it was like a one-off that he worked on Uncharted 4. I didn't know he was did a lot of fiction writing in general. Well, I guess that's not necessarily fiction, but you know what I mean.
He wrote
narrative.
I'm
writing.
Gonna jerk off Tom Bissell for a little bit. he wrote a short story that got turned into the film The Loneliest Planet. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
It stars Gael Garcia Bernal and I don't remember that actress. She's really great in it.
I'm kidding, by the way. Is that a person I should know?
Gael Garcia Bernal?
Yeah, I don't
you
know
don't?
Who that is. Wait, who? Maybe I do. Who is that?
He was in Itu Mama Tambien. Mozart in the Jungle.
Okay, so I know what both those are, and I know who you're talking about. I didn't know his name.
That's a really good movie.
Okay, all right, I'll check it out. Tom Bissell's great. People should read his writing. It's very, very good. He does this thing where I've heard him in a lot of interviews. People come, like, have him on, and he's, like, they're really excited to talk to him about his theories, and then he does this thing where he says, like, oh, I was wrong. I don't believe that anymore. Like, about a lot of his old stuff, which makes me sad, because I like a lot of his stuff, but, he's very talented.
I know he got, like, I think this, I might be making this up. No, but I'm pretty sure he got a rash of shit about stuff he wrote And then just kind of stopped doing video game criticism.
I mean, I think that's just something probably, unfortunately, inherent in video game criticism. Yeah, like, I think it's impossible to write about that medium without idiots. I mean, that's like saying, let's write about Star Wars and, you know. By the way, can I say that maybe my favorite thing I engaged with this entire last 2 weeks was, this has not stopped being my favorite joke of the month. A comedian I really like named Scott Aukerman, who has a very strange sense of humor, put out with no context a list of every Star Wars movie that's ever been made, but he just put them out in chronological order in which they've been released and put numbers next to each of them. But he didn't write anything else. He just was like, Star Wars movies, :1, A New Hope, :2,
he
whatever.
He even put the year they were released next to them to help cue people
in. And everyone in the thread lost their minds because they all were arguing that they were in the wrong order because everyone thinks he was putting them in, he was listing them as favorites. And every single person that he could respond to, whenever they made an argument, he would just say, yes, I enjoyed that one, or something, like, really, really...
Someone responded with their own ranking, and then he responded with, those are all out of order.
Those are all mixed up. Yeah.
But it's funny, it took me a good 10 seconds to realize what he was doing, because when I see a list now that has Star Wars 1977 at the top and Star Wars The Last Jedi at the bottom, I'm like... Or I guess Solo was at the bottom. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, but you immediately make all these assumptions about it. And of course everyone was losing their minds too about the prequels being higher than the new ones. And it was a perfect joke.
For
it was very,
a second,
very well executed.
I was like, wow, he got it right. Well, he got it right about putting Phantom Menace as the best of the prequels. And like, no one ever does that. And then... Like, oh,
I didn't realize you fell for it. That's great.
For a good 10 seconds. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, very good. Very good, Scott.
Yeah. So that's what's been going on with me. Not much. I am in town for a couple of weeks, so I'm looking forward to that. We both saw Solo and didn't like it very much.
Yeah.
I mean, hate it?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
I was talking to my buddy Jung, who I saw it with, and I was talking to Ian about it afterwards, and Solo's hard to hate because it tries to be so little, you know. It's the least ambitious Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
I
love that phrase, a horse built by committee. For those who aren't familiar, it's, you know, the story about how a committee comes together to design the perfect horse, and instead they design a camel, which is really ugly. And there's part of me that's like, well, don't shit on camels, but it still works as a story because it points out how impossible it is for a committee to build something well. And that's what this movie felt like. It was a lot of pieces, and I liked all the pieces, but they did not fit together in any way that made sense, really, to me.
Yeah.
Like, there was no one person I could point to and say they were bad, for instance.
I mean, there are things like, again, I think I've said Alden Ehrenreich, who plays Han Solo, has the most thankless job, perhaps, in the history of...
Agreed.
...acting.
Yeah, agreed.
...on film, and I think he does a good, admirable job of, like... kind of getting certain mannerisms down, but not doing an impersonation of Han Solo.
Absolutely. And there were little, I mean, these aren't spoilers, these are like just little jokes, but I like that, you know, like they turn into a joke that Lando says Han's name wrong to annoy him.
Yeah.
Like those kinds of things are fun little things. You saw it before me and you said, you know, oh, there's a lot of fan service and that annoyed me. And some of the fan service annoyed me, some of it didn't. I liked seeing, you know, them playing Sabacc together. I liked, all that. I think my biggest concern with that movie is the biggest problem that has always been a problem with the Star Wars narratives is what fucking category do we put droids in? Are they real? Are they robots?
It's a real problem in this movie.
And this movie, like, breaks that for the universe because it asks every single one of those questions you've ever had, those weird questions about droids, like when somebody hits a droid or puts a... you know, like, obedience chip in them or whatever, all that shit, like... But it doesn't answer any of the questions.
It does a weird thing where it opens the question, and I was happy to have them open it, and the character that they introduced, played by, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is a really great writer and actress. She's in a series called Fleabag that's amazing.
Can I ask a mildly uncomfortable question, and we can cut this out?
Yeah.
Is she black?
No.
Okay. If she was, I would say that I had a bigger problem with that character.
No, she's not. She's actually, I ended up picking something else, but probably in a couple episodes, I was going to pick a show that she that she writes and showruns, which is Killing Eve, which is an incredibly popular show.
I've heard amazing things about that show. Yeah,
but that character's great, and then it does something so heinous with the rules they set up within this movie to that character that I was baffled by it.
I also don't think that character is great. I think that they take the narrative of, like, civil disobedience and rebellion, like, socially speaking, and turn that into a comic relief character in a way that I found very unsettling. Like, you're supposed to be laughing at how much she wants to free all of these slave droids, and, like, that's like, kind of a problem for... I mean, I'm not trying to be PC here, it just... saying it doesn't work within the narrative. Like, it makes you uncomfortable about... Because then every other droid I look at for the rest of my Star Wars life, I'm gonna be like, well... Do they really want to be here?
But it opens that question within the movie. And yes, it is a comic relief thing. But I guess just following the rules or assumptions of a well-built narrative, I had assumed that movie was going to go somewhere further with that than it did. And then it didn't. And then it turned all of that on its head without, I think, really giving consideration to what it was doing.
Yeah, kind of what I mean by built by committee. There's all these pieces that don't have finish lines or something. Like, it's...
But the finish line there, I can see where a committee would go, isn't that nice? Because now you look at this thing from the previous canon in a different way. And I'm like, it's horrifying if you look at that thing from the previous canon.
Also, we're, like, not making sense because we're trying so hard to walk around spoilers. So we should maybe move on, I think.
I will say... two more things about, because there are a ton of call-outs. I mean, if you wanted Teres Kasi to be mentioned in a Star Wars movie, congratulations, it's your lucky movie. But there is a big split.
By the way, I read all the books, have played all the games. I did that reference went over my head. That's how deep cut some of these like nerd references are. Like Bobby had to remind me what Teres Kasi was. It's a Star Wars fighting game from like when we were in junior high, probably, right?
Yeah, I think it got it. I looked it up because I went, is that a mention from the PlayStation game? But it actually got its first mention in the novel Shadows of the Empire, or the Cross
of Media. Which I like that book, by the way, so that's funny. Yeah, I did all that. I missed all of that stuff. I was just... I will say Chewie was fun. I like Chewie.
I love, in the new movies, the debut of Chewie as his own character, kind of.
It's really totally fun. I also was thinking multiple times in that movie, they should have Chewie in scenes where it's windy more often, because he looks really cool.
And I never want to see Chewie wet ever again.
Yeah, that was gross.
It was really weird. You could see the outline of a man inside of Chewie.
Yeah, it's very, very creepy.
That. But, so it builds up to a big spoiler reveal that I thought was the most absurd thing that has potentially ever happened.
Agreed. And I've talked to two other people who were like, I thought it was really cool, and I do not understand them at all. I laughed out loud.
I did too. I was baffled by the decision that anyone thought that would be a cool thing to put in a movie.
And the more I've thought about it, the more confused I've gotten by the decision. So we can't,
we're not going to. But I also want to say, the climax of that movie is built on another kind of like throwaway Star Wars reference about Han. The final thing he does to resolve an argument.
I thought that was
tickled by that. I thought that was great.
I was too. Anyway, it actually was a little bit of a slow burn joke too. It took me like 3 minutes to realize what I had just seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Are we going to talk about, is there anything you want to talk about before we move on to our picks for the week?
Let's talk about Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
All right.
My thing is better than your thing.
So
Bobby, my pick for the week was Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It's a show, it's a sitcom by Michael Schur, who has done sitcoms such as some of my favorite sitcoms, like Parks and Recreation, which we've talked about, and also The Good Place, which is one of my current favorites, perhaps my favorite show on television right now. And he also did a lot of work on The Office, where he also played Dwight's cousin Moe's. But so I picked two episodes for you. There's an episode from season 2 called Ava, and then an episode from season 3 called Moo Moo. And I just wanted to ask you, Ian, what did you think of these?
You think you're so funny right now. You're like dying laughing about this. Is this something you planned to do ahead of time?
Nope.
So Bobby stole my pick for the week. Are you pretending that it's yours because I pick the best things ever and you're jealous about my track record?
That was really good.
I will say really quickly, this is super embarrassing, so I'm going to say it on the air because it's the only way to make it more embarrassing. It was very, very clear to me when I edited our last episode that I was really sad when you didn't like Punisher, but I was trying to hide it really well. And at the end of the episode, I could like just hear it in my voice, and it made me very embarrassed by my immediate reaction.
But
no, I'm not. You do not need to defend yourself at all. I'm making fun of me right now. I know you liked Punisher fine, but I was like really looking forward to this like slam dunk kind of moment, and you were like, it was okay. And I could tell I just like had the wind taken out of my sails for the next 5 minutes and was trying really well to hide it. So if you know me well enough to hear that kind of stuff, go back and re-listen to it with that in mind, because it's kind of funny how sad I get.
Anyway, so I did not care for Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
You did?
No,
yeah,
I'm joking.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm joking.
What have you seen of Brooklyn Nine-Nine before?
I watched like the first 3 episodes.
And what did you think at the time?
I liked them a lot. I don't know. I didn't keep watching.
You just didn't watch it because you didn't. Okay, so Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I actually did not know Mike Schur created that show. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your stupid joke at the beginning.
You didn't know until now?
I did not know that.
It says it in the credits of every episode.
I just didn't. I know Mike Schur and I just never noticed it. I don't know what's wrong with me. I watch every episode of that show and I've never put that together. That show is great. Andy Samberg is one of my favorite people. Are you a Lonely Island fan?
Yes.
That's a divisive group, and I get that, so not everybody is. You also, I know, are a big fan of their movies, of the Lonely Island's movies.
All of them,
including the stuff they haven't done together, like MacGruber.
But I love Hot Rod and I love Popstar.
Yeah, those are both fantastic movies. So that's what originally brought me to the show, and I really, really like him in the show. He's amazing. He's a great leading man. The show also just made me love a lot of other people. Stephanie Beatrice is doing something amazing in that show. That's I'm blanking on her name.
Diaz.
Rosa Diaz. Chelsea Peretti is incredible in that show. Andre Brower is incredible in that show. Joe Latruglio is doing something really great. And then, of course, Terry, who is really the centerpiece of our first episode and kind of the second one. So I picked these two.
So what I learned just
now
please. Is that you don't care for Melissa Fumero because she's the only one you didn't
mention. I am in love with her, by the way. The reason I didn't list her is because I seriously have the world's biggest crush on her. I think she's so gorgeous and I don't want to be creepy about her on the show. So we're not going there. But no, she's incredible as well.
Great.
Everybody on the show is great. But she is playing a little bit more of like a character we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why I didn't name her. She's playing Monica, basically. Like, she's this very type A, organized character. And really the reason that works best is because it bounces off the other characters well. So, like, all that Chelsea Pretty does is kind of shit on her. And obviously she's a love interest for Andy Samberg. And those two, like, the childish versus the, like, very, like, you know, particular and put together works really well, so that's all fun. But I picked these two episodes because the first one, which is about Terry, who is played by
Terry Crews,
his wife is giving birth, and I thought that was just a really good ensemble episode. It gives everybody a chance to kind of play to their strengths. And then the second one I gave you because I think this show does really interesting things with the fact that it is a show on television about police right now. So why don't you start with what your kind of initial thoughts were, and then we'll take it from there.
So there are a few things about Michael Schur shows that I think are constant, and
yeah.
I think that they are...
It totally makes sense that it's him. The second you said that, I was like, oh, I'm really stupid.
Yeah, and it's that, I mean... Uniformly, they have very strong casts. You like all of the characters,
mm-hmm.
and all of the characters like each other.
Mm-hmm,
They have a very strong familial sense. Even a show like The Good Place, where they're all kind of combative at the beginning.
Yeah. Even the dummies. I mean, so in this show, we have these two old white guys, and the joke of them is that they're kind of two old white guys. So they're cops from before...
Mm-hmm.
cops became what they are now, so they make a lot of jokes about them doing a ton of cocaine in the 80s and like all this stuff, and they're idiots, they don't know what they're doing. I said before we started the show, they're essentially a comedy version of the two guys we get at the beginning of The Wire,
yeah.
who eventually leave the show. But even they're not made fun of in a way that feels mean, like
mm-hmm.
you still get the sense that everybody would take a bullet for them, and it's there's something really sweet about his stuff. You're right.
Well, and everybody, even like the more straight man characters get to be the comic relief at times.
Yeah, like who is the straight man in that show? Is there one?
I mean, from what I remember in the first episode or so, the straight man would be the Melissa Fumero character. Or the Andre Bauer character. Yeah.
Actually, I think you're right. I think Melissa Fumero is kind of the straight man to everyone on that show. She's the foil to everybody else's crazy.
But in being the straight, like, once you establish a character as the straight man to everyone, they start to, like,
they become a caricature.
That's
too.
A comedic identity. Yeah.
And Andre Brower goes from straight man to something glorious very quickly on this show. I think he's probably hands down my favorite character in the series.
Yeah, he's great. And I think that Mike Schur's really great at balancing the focus. I think on both of these episodes, every single character has a moment to shine in both episodes.
Yes.
Which is hard to do when you are juggling a large cast.
Joe Truglio has kind of the best running joke I've ever seen in the first episode, which is everyone keeps saying these really sweet things to each other, and every single time he tries to jump in, they cut him off and say that it's a personal moment between the two of them. And he couldn't not look more like, yes, you're right, that was me, I screwed up. Like, he immediately backs off. He's just the most submissive person. His relationship with Andy Samberg on the show is that he thinks Andy is the coolest person ever, and Andy thinks Andy is the coolest person ever, and so they're best friends. So he's literally just, like, his sidekick puppy who follows him around. And he's very inappropriate in the process. He's constantly trying to talk Jake into getting Amy pregnant and get married, and, you know, he's a very inappropriate lapdog. It's a great character.
I will say, and I liked both of these episodes. An interesting journey I had with the first one, the Ava episode, was I wasn't into it as much as I thought I would be.
Sure.
And it's not a knock on that episode. I realize part of, with the state of television right now, the way I tend to watch shows is binging through them. Even sitcoms that don't necessarily have a serialized narrative,
which, like, the show does. It does have very clear, like, beginnings and ends of each season and all of that.
Parks and Rec did too. Yes, but you could watch an episode on its own. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could do that with, like, The Good Place, but But what you do in the process of doing that is you sort of learn the language of the show, and
you learn to love the characters already. Yeah.
And then also, as the show starts to heighten more and to become a little more sitcom-y, mm-hmm. in that, like, things that happen over these sets that they've, like, the handful of sets that they've built for the show.
Right.
You're willing to go with it a little more.
Yeah.
And so I was a little bit lost in that first episode. Like, oh, I could see where if I had, like, a built-in sort of affection for these characters,
sure,
that I would...
That's fair.
Be down more, but...
I run into that problem a lot with stuff I pick, because, especially with TV shows, there is a certain amount of love for characters that's required for mm-hmm. you to really... You know, I think that's a big way I failed with the episode of Better Call Saul that I picked, for instance. So I agree with you. I think that's fair. Well, let's talk about the second one, because that's really the reason I picked this show. And the show does a lot of things like this. This is the biggest, like, full episode that's dealing with a social issue in this way. But I think what is happening in this episode is kind of a mission statement for the show. They do try to talk a lot about representation and diversity in the police force. They try to talk a lot about what it means to be a police officer and a good police officer in the world they live in, what a bad police officer looks like. And this show is really hitting that on the head and doing some interesting things, I think, in the mm-hmm. process. So why don't you start and maybe give a brief description of what the episode's about, and then talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I don't know if you did this on purpose. Both these episodes are very Terry-centric.
They are. Terry, I love. I mean, they write really good shows about Terry. Terry's a fun character for me because Terry is a deconstruction of traditional masculinity. Terry Crews, obviously, is this huge, beefy, tough guy, and he's the sergeant on the show, and the running gag of him on the show is that before the show started, he was like a super cop, and then he had two little girls that he named Cagney and Lacey, and they, like, destroyed his ability to be a badass, so now he's just a dad who also looks like a linebacker, and I really enjoy that. So it was a little on purpose.
Yeah. It plays completely into my perception of what Terry Crews is like, too.
Yeah, agreed.
But so he's working to get a promotion into, like, as a liaison for something, yes, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the application process is really big, and so, you know, he has what are their names? Andy Samberg and Melissa Fumero's characters.
Yeah.
Jake and Amy. He has them babysit his daughters while he's getting this lengthy application process done. One of them loses a beloved blanket of one of his daughters.
Yes.
Which is hilarious and relatable. And
so he goes... That sounds so robotic.
No, it is, though. I mean, like... One of the defining moments of my childhood was when my sister, who was like 3 at the time, lost her like beloved stuffed animal.
Okay.
And our whole family went into mourning over this thing, and Angela like couldn't sleep. And then we finally found out my soccer coach had found it like abandoned on the field during practice, and he had it. And so she got it back. It was amazing. It was like losing a family member and having them come back to life.
But did you feel this way too?
Yes.
You were like that concerned for her. That's beautiful, yeah. Bobby.
I mean, we
you're Angela, a good older brother. I would just been like screw husk, you, find a new blanket.
She was like a husk of a human being. I mean, like one of the advice that we as a family gave to, we're always just like, no, if you have a beloved stiff animal, buy 12 of them.
Also
make them not important, you know? Because Angela still has that stuffed animal.
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
So he goes, Terry goes searching through the neighborhood to find this blanket. He finds it, he bends down, picks it up, and gets pulled over by a police officer.
Yes.
Who profiles him, is immediately hostile to him.
Played by the guy who dates Deborah and Dexter. I don't know his name, but he like looks like a slimy, like New Yorker type of guy. He's good at that. He's white.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so, everything with that, I mean, like he gets out of it. He just comes to work the next day really disturbed by what happens.
To be clear, what happens is very clearly that Terry Jeffords is pulled over for being black.
Yep.
He asks the cop what he's done. The cop handcuffs him and puts him on the ground. And then you find out that the only reason he let him go is because he found out he was a police officer.
Right. And so he sits down with this cop because he just wants to talk to him about what happened. And this cop apologizes for pulling him over because he's a cop and not because he's, you know.
I think he literally says, if I had known you were a cop, I never would have done that. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Terry takes exception to that and wants to, file a complaint against him. But his captain, played by Andre Brower, is like, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Who is a gay black man.
Yes.
And that is very important to his role in the show. There's multiple moments in the show where the rest of the team goes to bat for him about issues of homophobia and racism. He has a lot of conversations about how he was like a super badass cop, but also a loner when he was young because nobody took him seriously. So that's, he has very clearly in the show, like dealt with issues of racism and sex and homophobia and things like that.
And the argument that the two of them, not the argument, but the conversation that Terry and, Captain Holt have is just really fascinating, and how that ultimately
it's very nuanced,
resolves.
Right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel preachy because they both have an opinion that makes sense, and it gets to the right place, I think, for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really, it feels like Mike Schur. That's what you're saying. There's no argument, nobody's yelling at each other, but there is a disagreement, and they reach a place where that makes... I don't know. Talking a lot.
And the thing I really... You had mentioned last week that... or last episode, a couple weeks ago, that this was as close as Brooklyn Nine-Nine has to a very special episode.
Yeah.
But it never kind of goes into, like, self-serious sappiness or anything.
Right.
It's a funny, entertaining show. There's a B story that's hysterical, but also equally poignant about... the Andy Samberg and Melissa
Jake
Fumero.
And Amy Jake and Amy are babysitting the kids after this happens, and the kids who are 4, right? Something like that, basically say, why did Daddy get arrested? And they're terrified. They don't know what to say. And then they say, did Daddy get arrested because he's black? Will we get arrested because we're black? And it's a great moment. And it's a fun scene, weirdly, because mm-hmm. you get to watch these two people, like, lose their minds trying to figure out how to answer this question without fucking up two children.
Right.
Yeah.
And he takes the idea that, because there's, there's initially this thing where they distract them with cake. Yeah. And the kids are happy to be distracted by cake, and then they babysit them again the next day, and then they just bring a bunch of cake with them. And the kids are smarter than that. They're like, yeah, we don't really want cake, but did Dad get arrested because he's black? You know, like, they just resume the conversation immediately from where they left off the night before.
Right.
And, accompanying that with two non-black characters kind of struggling to figure out how they should talk about this issue is really mm-hmm. interesting.
I think one of my favorite things about the show, and you kind of said this already, you said that Terry Jeffords, Terry Crews's character feels very much like Terry Crews.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important part of the show. I think they're really good at writing to people's strengths. And mm-hmm. I also get the sense on a lot of occasions that they go to the actors and talk to them about their political kind of where they have a dog in the fight in this kind of mm-hmm. stuff. Because the second that Stephanie Beatriz came out as bi publicly, they wrote her character as bi. That was like immediately the first thing they did. And there's a lot of that kind of stuff with Terry Crews on the show. There's a lot of that kind of stuff with, Andre Brower is not actually gay, I don't think, but they do a lot of stuff with him in the show in that way too. So Bobby just looked down at his phone and got sad because he got a HQ alert, and he can't play right now because we're doing the podcast. I just want to share that. He thought I didn't see it, so he's smiling very embarrassed right now.
I won HQ last week. It was a big deal.
How much did you win, Bobby? Are you a millionaire now?
$21.
Yeah, all right.
That's a lot to win from HQ.
Yeah, it is. That is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, it's all downhill from here.
Would you say you liked the show?
What? I thought you were asking me a question about
HQ.
The session of HQ I won. I'm like, yeah, I always like it.
I hate you.
Yeah, I love the show. Okay. Wait, another thing, and this is such a weird thing to say about that second episode.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to say this without sounding insensitive to, like, the issues of police violence.
Sure.
All of that. Because obviously I think that's really important, and I think that's a pressing issue in our society. I have a lot of law enforcement in my family. I'm one of my good friends recently got sworn in as a police officer, and I know that largely, mostly, police officers are good people mm-hmm. who want to do good in the world. Mm-hmm. And, while I might take issue with how a lot of that class of, how a lot of good police officers are, reacting to the current political climate, even though I know they would never do anything like that, mm-hmm. I like that this show was able to address this issue sensitively, but also show law enforcement
sensitively
and in a good light,
There's this show does that. There's an episode where there's an active shooter situation and Rose is stuck there and the rest of them are just freaking out at mm-hmm. work, right? I think this show does a really good job. Like, I think I'm going to repair what you just said. It does a really good job of putting a friendly alternative face on the NYPD specifically that doesn't erase or pretend like stuff isn't happening. That is definitely happening. And it's showing us an opportunity. It's giving us an opportunity to see good police. The show doesn't really have any machismo to it, right? The two mm-hmm. kind of hero male leads, one of them is Terry, who's like a mess, and that's the joke of him. The other one is Andy Samberg, who is only a badass because Die Hard's his favorite movie, and he's obsessed with becoming John McClane, and it's kind of like an endearing, childish thing about him.
Yeah.
Other than that, we have the most submissive man in the world in Joe Latruglio. We have a gay black
Joe Latruglio
captain.
Playing the most Joe Latruglio that
has
ever
we
been.
Have we have a sociopathic white woman and two Hispanic women, one of whom is bi. Like, it doesn't feel, you don't watch a show and say like, oh, they tried to fill all these roles like to like hit a diversity checkbox, but it just feels like a very natural progression of things. I don't know, I love it. It's a great show. It's also very funny, by the way. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is very silly. When you say heightened, you're right. I would say this show goes a little more cartoony than most of Mike Schur's other stuff. Although Good Place gets to go cartoony in a different kind of way because it's like magic and stuff. But, you know, I think this goes a lot sillier than Parks and Rec did. Or cartoonier.
It's definitely more breakneck with its jokes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It will just, everyone talks very, very fast. Yeah. It cuts to scenes right after a punchline lands, so you barely have a chance to laugh at it. Yeah. I mean this in a good way, yeah. where it's just...
It feels full. It's full of jokes in the same way that, like, Kimmy Schmidt or Arrested Development or something like that, that is. It's a very, like, joke-heavy television show.
But it takes, like, it's like a comedy that takes the pacing of, like, a fast-talking cop show.
Yeah.
You know, if that makes sense?
Definitely.
Like, so jokes are delivered at the same pace as, like, exposition is delivered on, like, a Law and Order or something.
It also, like, it isn't afraid to go dark with some of the jokes. Like, it does show them dealing with real stuff. Like, for instance, the beginning of the first episode, the joke is that Joe Latruglio is coming in on Halloween, or on Thanksgiving, dressed as a turkey and talking in a turkey voice to everyone. And Andy Samberg is trying to stop him because the people that are sitting at his desk are looking for their grandmother who disappeared, and clearly Joe Latruglio found out that she's dead and has to explain it to them in a turkey costume, which is fantastic.
So, it's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it.
Good show. Good show.
It's very good.
All right. All right, are we going to move on to your stupid thing that nobody really likes?
Yep.
All right.
Experience life. Experience laughter,
experience sound,
experience love,
experience life,
experience lust,
experience pain,
experience Bobby.
So this week I picked a little iPhone app that I don't like at all. I don't know why I picked it, called Florence.
Why'd you pick it?
I love Florence. Bobby picked it. Why don't you talk about it?
Okay, so Florence is a... Florence is an iPhone game. I was talking briefly to Ian before how I went out of my way to call it not a game last episode, and there's this really gatekeepery bullshit that goes into video game culture right now where, like, what is a game even? And yeah, you can't lose Florence. You're never, like, competing with Florence in the traditional sense.
Yes.
So, but it undoubtedly uses video game mechanics to tell a story.
I would say that it is a interactive comic book that is very, very heavily reliant on game theory.
Yeah.
You could call that a video game. I have no problem with that.
Yeah. I would file that away in video games. Like, you can't lose Matt. Well, I mean, you can lose Mass Effect 2, but, like, you know, but you can't lose most modern video games. And I don't think the fail situations of modern video games are necessarily what compels people to play.
Right. Sure.
But anyway, so Florence is it's a very small story about a young woman who is kind of not happy with her place in life, and she meets a cellist named Krish. And I kind of want to talk about it a little bit without spoilers, if that's cool, and then we can dive into spoilers.
Yes. So, yeah, let's do that. First off, I really did love this. It's very impressive to me. I studied, you know, digital media in college as part of my grad school stuff, and this really kind of, like, hit me in a lot of places that I like. I showed it to a few other people who all loved it, too. I highly recommend it. It's about $3, and it's like a 30-minute game.
Which,
game, like,
you'd
like that.
Spend $3 on a TV episode that was 30 minutes.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. Why don't you start? Because I don't know what you mean by spoilers exactly.
So I don't want to ruin how it ends, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
That's what I want to say.
So the way that this works that I loved is that it's very, very slightly interactive, but that interactivity elicits an emotional response in us and lets us know how we're supposed to feel about the scene. So, for instance, there's this... The game starts with this meet cute between these two characters, and this is when this is the moment where I decided I loved the game. They go on a date together, and these word bubbles pop up above their head. Everything's drawn. It's kind of motion comic-y drawn. There's this really beautiful score to it. The music is really good.
The music's incredible.
And on their date, they're talking to each other, and when these word bubbles pop up above their heads, these little puzzle pieces show up underneath. And you have to put them together in the shape of the word bubble to say something back to Chris. You're playing as Florence. And when it starts, there's like five or six little puzzle pieces, and then as the date goes on, the puzzle pieces get bigger and there's less of them, meaning it's easier to talk to him. And then the date ends with one solid word bubble that you can just put right into it, and you kiss him goodnight, because it just feels like that's the natural next step.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it really did elicit in me this response of like getting more comfortable mm-hmm. while the date was going. So I was like, oh, I get the rules of this. I get what's happening. And it was great. Now that's a very, very simple example of the kinds of stuff this game does.
And I think there's little to no dialogue in this game.
There is no dialogue. The only...
You can choose what you want to say to your mother when you're on the phone with her.
But it doesn't change anything, and there's only like five different things you can say, and they recycle. So all you can say is like, no, thank you. Yes, I love you too. Like, no, I don't have a boyfriend right now. Like, there's only like five or six things you can say, and it's clearly just supposed to create in you this image that they've had the same conversation 3 million times.
Right. And so what it does is it takes like kind of the love story formula, the romantic comedy formula, and boils it down to its most essential elements and replaces all of the text with video game mechanics, which I think is really interesting. Yeah. It's a really interesting way to tell a story.
I will say this is kind of like, I felt like this was the video game equivalent of the last 5 years. you picked these two things that are basically the same thing, just done in a different medium.
Someone wrote, I was reading a bunch of reviews on Florence, someone wrote it was a tear-jerking WarioWare.
Yeah, that's fair.
I thought that was...
Kaylin played it yesterday and said that it made her cry a lot, and then I was over at my friend Chris and Daniel's with my brother and his girlfriend Kaylin yesterday, and I watched Chris play it, and everybody really enjoyed it. It's, you know, it is a narrative that some people might dismiss. I will say that it's a cool idea, and there's a part of me, not a big part of me, a very small part of me that wishes there was something else like it that wasn't in like the rom-com variety, because there's people I would want to recommend this to that I think might immediately mm-hmm. dismiss it because of the content of the narrative, but I loved it. That's my only very small nitpick, and that's not to say I don't like this one. I'd like it a lot, and I think it's done and created very well. I wish... Or maybe they did make more in different genres. I just think it's a cool new narrative style that I've never seen before.
This is a game by this I believe, I'm sorry if I'm getting any of this wrong. Yeah. Not that anyone's ever going to listen to this. But this is the first game from the studio that made this. It's a studio created by Ken Wong, who was a lead designer on Monument Valley, which is a really great mobile game, but it's nothing like this. But is also just very visually interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go into spoiler territory now. What I really, it kind of, and not that it doesn't take turns we haven't seen in a story before, but it certainly, went a different way than I thought this narrative was going to go. And it, so...
The interactivity allows you to do things within this type of narrative that you don't normally see in this type of narrative.
Yeah.
So for instance... There's a point where you and Krish move in together.
Yes.
And the little interactive moment there is that it shows different rooms in your house, and you have to put his stuff, take his stuff out of the box and put it up on the shelves with your stuff, but there isn't enough room for both. Mm-hmm. And there's no right or wrong to this. You can do whatever you want, but you feel the sense of like, I don't want to take some of my stuff down though. I like my stuff. I don't want to just put up all of his stuff. And I found myself like putting up stuff that I think Florence would like that was also his. You know, like there's a lot of that kind of thing. And that's a moment in a relationship, right?
Yeah.
It's a moment of like, there's a secret selfishness to that that people don't talk about. And there might be lines in a movie that do that, but I don't think they elicit that feeling in you as effectively as that scene did.
Yeah.
So there's just all these little moments like that. That's just an example of that.
There's a mirror of that scene later where, we're into spoiler territory.
Yeah.
By the end of the game, Krish is moving out of the apartment, and you're, as Florence, Florence and Krish's things have melded together, and you're not sure...
You can't remember for sure what was his.
Right,
and
so you have to put his stuff back into the box, and you feel like you're clearing Florence's house out.
Yeah, and you're also not sure if you're doing it right, and there's a part of you that's like, well, also, who cares? I just want to get to the next thing, because it's not fun now, it's sad now, and... Yeah.
And there's a moment, you know, we talked about the beautiful first date, which is one of my favorite parts of the game. I just think that's really inventive. Later on, you get into an argument with Krish, and the puzzle pieces are all jagged, and they just keep spitting out. And Krish is spitting out. You don't get to see what he's saying, but he's spitting out word bubbles. And so you're trying to, as quickly as you can, put these puzzle bubbles together, you know, so you can match his argument. You're trying to win an argument, and you kind of step back after a while and go, like, why? What are we even fighting
And that's
over?
Done very effectively, because when he talks, the whole game
shifts.
He shifts. Yeah. There's a horizontal shift on the screen, so he's up
imbalanced.
A little higher.
Yeah.
And then you have to shift it back. And so there is a sense you're like, I have to get it out fast. So
right.
And then that fight is heartbreaking, because by the end of it, again, mirroring the beginning, there's a lot of mirroring in this.
Mm-hmm.
The last fight you have with him, all of the word bubbles aren't puzzle pieces. They're full word bubbles, because it's really easy to fight with him now. It's really easy to argue.
Yeah.
So, and then there's also this moment of, I think the moment that most hit me in the entire game is every scene starts and you basically figure out what you're supposed to be doing in the scene by touching the screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
You touch different areas, and once something moves, you're like, oh, that's what I'm doing here. You know, you draw a picture, or you bring Krish and Florence closer together, whatever. And there's this moment right at the end where he's walking away. It's not really him. It's like a ghost. It's his memory of him is walking
away. It's after
away.
He's moved out.
Yeah.
It's after you've thrown away all of the stuff that reminds you of
him.
It's
you and him are walking together to the left of the screen, horizontal, like, you know, in a landscape. And he starts walking ahead of you, and he's see-through. It's like the memory of him. And I kept touching the screen, and he kept stopping, and I couldn't figure out what to do. And then I realized in that moment, the way you get to the next scene is not trying to stop him anymore, by just letting him go. And you have to, for the first time in the game, do nothing to proceed to the next level. And that, I found that very effective.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to kind of let time help you get over it. It's a really cool emotional effect
for
the game. Yeah.
And there's a couple of really interesting emotional things it does at the end. There's a moment where you're frantically trying to hold this your relationship together, and you're trying to put a torn photo back together, and as the parts are drifting away, and there's just, it's really hard to do. And then there's another part where you're trying to put a puzzle together, and you realize the pieces aren't going to fit no matter how hard you try.
I want to talk about that for a second, because I think that's the best designed moment in the game. After their first big fight, it shows the two of them lying in bed, and you have seen a previous picture of them lying in bed. This scene uses recycled images or images that remind you of other images really, really well as the narrative progresses. And you recognize, oh, this is the same scene as before, but now they're sad. And because it's two people, you can put each person together very easily out of the puzzle pieces, because you can see where the head, legs, and feet are, all that. But then when you try to put them together, I had them facing each other and it wouldn't fit. And then I said to myself, you know, because that's the size that they started on, I said, oh, they're facing away from each other. That's how I put the puzzle together. And I put them on the other sides, and they were facing away looking sad, and the puzzle still didn't fit.
Yeah.
And then it ended. It just moved on. And I was like, oh, that's a gut punch. That's an amazing moment, because that was game theory working perfectly. I did exactly what they wanted me to do in the exact order they wanted me to do it, with very little prompting, and got exactly the message that they were trying to send. It was really, really well done.
Another thing I really love about this as a narrative is, I read a really gushing review from Feminist Frequency about this too, is that...
Is this well known?
Like, it's fairly well known.
I've never heard of it. So,
I mean, I don't think it's, like, best-selling or anything.
Right,
but,
right. But, I mean, people are writing blogs about it and stuff. It's not just some random thing. How did you find it, I guess?
Actually, I found it because there was a... This makes me sound like such a tool.
Yeah, you are. It's fine.
The iOS
you heard
app
about
store.
It at Hamilton?
Yeah, I heard about it at
Hamilton.
There was
a booth at Hamilton?
They had a booth. I picked up some Florence merch. No, on the app store, on my iPhone, what Apple's doing now is they write features about apps that they're highlighting. And they wrote a feature on Florence, and I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. And then I just bought it, and it really... really, really blew me away.
Yeah. Sorry, so you were saying something about a critic that you...
Yeah, and so, and I think this is a lot of what I like about it as far as subverting, rom-coms or that sort of narrative, is that ultimately the note that this ends on isn't the idea that Florence and Krish need each other to complete each other. It ends very much on a note of Florence being self-sufficient, being in a better place at the end than she was in the beginning. A lot of that because of what she experienced in her relationship with Krish, but not not needing another person to complete her.
One of the narratives in the game that I think speaks to that really well is the game is kind of about her pushing him and him pushing her to be better, right? I think that you get the sense that's probably what they're fighting about too. She makes him try out for cellist opportunities and things like that. She's an artist. She used to be when she was a kid. She finds this thing early on that she drew when she was young, and he buys her a paint set because of that, and then slowly mail accumulates on top of it. And the game ends with her, after he's left, pulling the paint out that he bought her and drawing again. And it is beautiful because she's doing it because of him, but she's doing it for herself, right? Yes. Like so he made her.
It comes after you let go of him.
She's happier because he touched her life. That's a good thing. This game is not, you know, it's really easy in narratives to say like, oh, if somebody's in a relationship, that's not a feminist thing because like, oh, you don't need a relationship. But this is positive about relationships, even though it ends slightly sadly. But she is a self-sufficient person. She relied on him too much, and she's kind of learning that. She's learning to not rely on him to give herself meaning. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense.
And I really like that, too. Is that kind of what you were saying? Or?
Yes, yeah. No, that's exactly what I was saying. And when I think of the moments at the end that really emotionally affect me, the moments that stay with me, it's, you know, Florence finds success, personal success, you know, with exploring her passion and, you know, is able to open up an online store and a gallery that is able to sustain her so she can drop out of her, you know, her data entry job, which is the most unrealistic millennial thing that this game portrays.
Yeah, but I will say the way that it ended and all of a sudden she's best friends with her mom now, it's like, no, she's not. I know her mom and I know her, and she's definitely not best friends with her mom now that she's successful.
But there's something touching about the idea that she's, because I don't think the game is trying to say, now she's successful and she can talk to her mom.
I know.
It's enabling her. She's more emotionally honest with her mom.
Yes, yeah, I think that's fair. I think I had projected too much of her mom's expectations onto that first call. When you see the end, you realize, oh, maybe that was more her being embarrassed about who she was and not talking to her mom.
Yeah, and Florence is not communicating with her mom during those phone calls. No, her mom is nagging her, but she's withholding all of the information of her life from her mom.
And very clearly just has the most resentful face ever on while she's, yeah.
But what the moments that really hit me at the end are you know, as she's packing up her workstation, she finds a photo of her and Krish on having a really good day, like a Polaroid. And we've seen her earlier throw away everything, and she places it in her box.
Do you have to do that?
I did do that,
yeah. But I noticed you can you have maybe the option to close the box without putting the picture in.
You do not,
I
tried.
Okay, and I thought that would have been really interesting, but because this is not a game with choice to it. It's not a you know, branching narrative or anything like that we're used to with a lot of.
Because I think the point of that is now she's approaching it at a better place. You know, she looks back on it fondly, and the final shot of that game is her content staring out a window. You mentioned kind of briefly the music in this.
That's great. It's amazing. Yeah, you should.
By Kevin Pankin. It's really, it's simple. It's like a string quartet and a piano and a...
You can hear it playing right
clarinet,
now over
I think.
The...
But so, there was a thing that was hitting me at the end, like emotionally, I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And so it's like, when we first meet Florence, we get her theme, and her theme sounds like this. It's kind of like a bright piano kind of melody.
Yes.
And then when she meets Krish, like kind of the Krish theme or the Krish and Florence theme is this really beautiful cello theme, which goes like this. And so at the end, when you see Florence kind of like thriving in her own personal life, they go back to Florence's theme, and her moving on theme is the two of them coming together.
Huh.
And that's like her music, and it sounds like this. Anyway, so when those two things came together at the end, it would hit me so, like, it would just really hit me. And I'm like, why is that? And I'm realizing, like, the game does a really beautiful job of setting up, like, a musical theme for Florence and a musical theme for Krish. And at the very end, after she's let go of him, having those two come together and having, like, the Krish theme inform Florence now.
Yes. Because she, like, has been touched by him. That's why I think it's important that, it's good, actually, I think, that you have to take the picture now that you talk about it that way, because she is who she is now because she was with him too, like because of their time together, not like she doesn't have him to thank for it or whatever, but like it's she's different because of this experience, and that's a good thing. Like, I love this game, by the way. It was really, really good.
And so, yeah, I think the point of, like, the point of all this isn't that these two people are meant for each other, mm-hmm. and they, you know, should be together forever. It's the idea that, you know, it's the, it contextualizes the relationship in her life, you know, and it's...
I want to, yes, absolutely. I want to retract one thing I said, and then I want to complain about one very small thing, because I only have one complaint about this game. The retraction is, I said earlier that there's a moment I fell in love with this game, and that's true. The moment that I did that was when I really fell in love with it, but the first moment in the game I laughed out loud at, which is, the game starts, it says, you know, Florence Yao, is that how you say her last name? 25, and then the alarm clock starts going off underneath her while she's asleep. It's 7 a.m., you hit the alarm clock, and then the screen goes black, and then the alarm clock goes off again at 7:15, and you hit it this time, and then she wakes up. I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
it's like a very, very small thing that humanizes her immediately, and I don't know if you do this, but I set 15 alarms in the morning because I hate waking up, so it just was really, it was like a very small, nice, yeah, exactly. The thing that I want to complain about, and it's a very small complaint, the only reason it's really a complaint is it's right at the beginning of the game. There's this weird thing where you fall off a bike when you have this meet cute with Krish, and you have to move these three
dials
so that you can focus the picture. And it's fine, you have to do it like three times, and the third time there's more dials, and it's just a little bit too sensitive. You have to get it exactly right to move on. And when I was playing the game, it didn't bother me, but when I recommended it to Kaylin and Chris, I remember thinking to myself, oh, I should tell them that I don't like this one part, because I don't want them to be like, oh, this is stupid. It's getting, like, actually hard to do in a way that I don't like. So I do think that slightly takes the tone somewhere else for just a minute, and I think it takes away from the... Like, I think every other mechanic like that adds a lot to the emotional response of that scene. I don't think that one does.
I didn't have trouble with it, but I would agree with you as far as mechanics in that game go, that has less to do with the moment than a lot of the other challenges.
Yeah. Everything else felt like it was very specifically designed to help me with me understanding the emotional stakes of the scene, and I didn't feel like that in that one. And it's only because it's right at the beginning. If there was a little misstep like that at the end, I think it would matter less, but because first impressions matter when you're taking on a piece of media, you know?
I also want to bring up, it's cool, it's very small, Florence is Chinese. I think they're Australian. I don't think they're American. She's Chinese Australian, and Krish is of Indian heritage, and that's cool.
Definitely. Yeah, sure. We're talking. This is our diversity podcast week, I guess.
Guys, I don't know if you know, we're so woke. We're incredibly woke.
We're like super liberal guys. I don't know if you know that.
I name drop Feminist Frequency.
We're ridiculous.
We got to shut it down right now.
Sorry, my back hurts a little bit. I think I've been patting it too much.
My favorite thing is so we're able to like isolate our audio better when we're recording separately, because when another person's talking, we can be loud and we know we can just do this later. And so like, this is going to sound a lot worse because we're in the same room.
Yeah, Bobby and I... Oh, go ahead. I
have this gigantic water jug with ice in it that I can't drink out of because it's going to make so much noise. And then Ian and I went back and forth at the beginning of this to decide whether Ian was going to sit in a chair or on his bed, which would make the least amount of noise. And Ian has been frantically, like, swinging his legs around on his bed this entire podcast.
I'm sorry. I'm a fidgety guy. I definitely kicked your water bottle once very loudly, and you looked at me and then moved it with just this dead look in your eye. I'm sorry. I'm annoying.
People will definitely hear my water bottle.
I will say that I think this podcast has given both of us a pretty severe complex about the annoying things we do in conversation. For me, it's interrupting way, way too much. And when we edit separately, I can, you know, if I just start talking over you and I have to keep the section in that I said, I can delete your language so it doesn't sound like I'm being a rude jackass. And I've been trying really, really hard to not do it here because I'm sure it's going to sound worse than normal. So
I've given Ian shit because there was an episode a few months ago where Ian talked at length for like 5 minutes.
For like 5 minutes.
About what's that?
Xenoblade Chronicles 2.
Which wasn't like a bad rant or anything. He just went on for a long time.
It didn't make sense if you hadn't played the game.
But so that was his week to edit. He cut the whole thing out. And so the finished product sounds like Ian going, "So I'm really into Xenoblade Chronicles 2 right now." And then me, very disinterested, going, "That's cool. So I'm playing Zelda." It sounds like I cut him off when really I sat there patiently for 5 minutes listening about Xenoblade Chronicles.
Yeah, you really, really did. I'm sorry for making you look like the bad guy there. So. Well, whatever. I very obviously was fighting back a burp on the podcast last week and you left that in, so.
Did I?
Yeah.
I left in a sneeze once because then I started making fun of you about the sneeze and I thought it was funny.
So what we're trying to say is we're going to start a second podcast that is about how we make podcasts.
Yeah.
And it's coming out every 3 days, so go ahead and subscribe to that. Bobby, I think we did something really special today, which is on an episode I'm editing, we're going to be under an hour and 15 minutes.
So terrified as to what our next episode is going to be.
Yeah, I know. We're going to do a 2-hour one next time. Bobby, I think next week we should do a list of our top 20
Well, we have a...
Something.
We have a spot right now for a third segment if you want.
No, I'm good.
What are you doing next week?
Next week, I have a couple of things in the hopper, and then I found out...
In the hopper? Is that a thing?
I think so.
What
Maybe I just get that from my parents.
What
I don't
is
know.
A hopper?
I don't know. In the hopper. I'm looking this up right
coming,
now, so...
Coming... Down the pike? That's a thing.
In the hopper. You have to vamp while I do this.
Oh,
When something is in the hopper, it is going through the last refinements before it is ready to begin or
wow.
be presented.
That's
a hopper
thing.
Is part of an agricultural or industrial machine that is a sorting device for separating things such as grain and chaff. So, not only is it real, I used it exactly right.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
So, go fuck yourself.
For the first 29 years of my life, I thought it was splitting image and not spitting image.
Yeah, yeah. One of my friends thought it was Heyer Hitler. she thought all of the Germans were screaming, "Hire Hitler! Hire Hitler!"
Like
hire him.
Like, go
like,
hire
him
or
job.
Give him a job?
Give him a job, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I had a couple things in the hopper, but then I found out something that shocked me. One of my favorite Netflix shows ever, which I have now watched, I think, 3 times, Bobby has never seen before. And I texted him, because I was rewatching it recently, and said that the pilot is maybe the best... single kind of mission statement for a show I've ever seen in a pilot. It's maybe one of my favorite pilots ever. And you responded by saying, "I've never seen the show." So this next time, I'm giving you the pilot of the Netflix original series GLOW, which stands for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, starring Alison Brie and Marc Maron. And it is fantastic, and I cannot wait to talk to you about it. Created by Jenji Cohen, by the way.
Hemlock GLOW.
What? Is that your pick?
No, is that what we're watching? That was
That
was a Netflix joke. I was what's a stupid Netflix show?
I didn't even
like,
know
bro.
What you were talking about. It sounded
like,
just
like,
familiar enough, I didn't understand you were doing a bit. So.
Not the Eli Roth show, Hemlock Grove.
There's an Eli Roth show called Hemlock Grove?
Yeah,
I mean, I know Hemlock Grove. I don't know why I said it like that. I didn't know he was involved in it.
I think it was in Eli Roth's show. It's not
Eli Roth's, like, not good, right? Have we decided that as a culture? I don't think I've ever seen one of his movies, so I feel a little hesitant to say that, but...
I don't know. I mean, like...
What was the cannibalism one that everybody
Green
did?
Inferno.
Green
That's
Inferno,
the only thing I can really point at, and I'm like, yeah, he sucks. I mean, like, as far as Hostel and stuff goes, I don't know about any of the socio-political stuff, but I think there's a place for just, like, torture porn.
Yeah. I am a fan of the Bear Jew in Inglourious Bastards. He's great
he
in that movie.
He is the Bear Jew.
He's also very, very funny in Piranha 3D, which is a very bizarre movie, so.
I liked his, he did Thanksgiving, right?
Yes, he did do Thanksgiving.
The Thanksgiving preview in Grindhouse was pretty good.
Have you seen Piranha 3D?
No. Should I?
We might pick that one eventually.
Oh my god, is it on 3D Blu-ray?
I don't know, but it's...
Because I can watch 3D Blu-rays on
my PS4. I remember, this is one of my favorite memories. I use it in the classroom because I teach a little bit about what... I teach a little bit about horror novels and fiction and why they're a part of our culture. And there's a lot of like punishment and sacrifice elements to that. And I use this story from when I was young. I saw Piranha 3D in theaters with my little brother, who was definitely too young to see it with me at the time. I think he was 14. And there's a scene where Adam Scott is, you know, he's the hero of the movie, and he's yelling for everyone to get out of the water because the piranhas are coming, and it's spring break, so nobody does. And, of course, they all start dying, and, you know, there's blood everywhere. And my brother leaned over to me and whispered very, very seriously. It was not a joke at all. And he said, "I don't feel bad for them at all. He told them to get out of the water." And I really, really love that moment. So
that's great.
Anyway, what are you picking next week?
All right, so I have, like, a weird relationship. I have a very complicated relationship with, like, reboots and sequels.
Sure, sure.
And that's to say I happily roll my eyes at them and laugh at the lesser people who are super excited for reboots and shit. But then also, on Free Comic Book Day, I bought a Power Rangers comic because, oh, my God, Power Rangers, you know?
Oh, man. Are we doing a Power Rangers comic next time? Okay.
And so I think the question with, like, reboots is whether you just want to rehash what was popular to begin with or if you want to go in a new direction and build off of what's already there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to assign you the first two episodes of the recent reboot of Roseanne. And
No, I'm joking. Oh, my God. You're such a jerk. I don't even know what my face looked like when you just said that.
I'm going to give you the first two episodes. This sounds equally ridiculous. I'm giving you the first two episodes of the YouTube Red series, Cobra Kai, which is created by Josh Hurd and also John Hurwitz and Hayden Schlossberg, who created Harold and Kumar.
Okay. I'm very excited to watch this. I've been meaning to anyway. We actually talked about doing this already, and I forgot that this is what you were going to say, which is why the Roseanne thing totally worked on me. I've heard this show is great, so I'm very, very excited. The first two are available for free,
The first two are available for free. I have actually only watched the first two.
I will say, if it's as good as I've heard it was, you can probably expect me to have seen all six or eight of them or whatever by next time we do this. So
I want to preface this with saying, it is a YouTube series, it's very low budget.
I'm fine with that.
It stars, gloriously, Billy Zabka and Ralph Macchio reprising their roles from the original.
I'm sorry, did you just call him Ralph Macchio?
Is it Macchio or Macchio?
It's actually Macchiato, Bobby.
Okay. It stars Billy Zabka and the triple Ralph Macchiato.
No, that was really good. You want to take that again?
No. I hate myself. I didn't even go for, like, the easy, like, venti Ralph Macchiato. That would have been better. I don't know why I didn't do that.
Yeah, me neither.
God.
Didn't you used to work at Starbucks, Bobby?
I'm gonna take next week off is what's gonna happen. But it's very low budget. Ralph Macchio, especially, is, like, not a great actor.
He is for what he does. Loved him in My Cousin Vinny, and he's doing a very specific thing in My Cousin Vinny, which is going, "What?" all the time. And I'm fine with that. Like, that sounds like what this is gonna kind of be, too.
I am so excited about where this show chooses to put Johnny and Danny, you know, 30 years later or whatever, and
that's what
it's definitely a show about them. It's not, so far, it's not a show about them passing the torch onto a new generation. It's a show about, like, what if two people who were rivals in high school, like, never got over it.
Yeah, okay. That's what I've heard,
I really like those first two episodes.
You think that we have How I Met Your Mother to thank for this reboot? Because Billy Zabka, I think that was the first time I've seen him in about 15 years.
What was he in How I Met Your
Mother? Oh, he plays himself. The running joke on How I Met Your Mother is that Barney thinks Billy Zabka is the hero of
movie. I totally forgot
about
that.
And he hires Billy Zabka to be his, like, best man at his wedding or something, I think. I forget exactly what it is.
I don't know what he's been up to, I'm not saying it's like...
He's probably done a lot of theater and stuff, I'm sure. Yeah,
I'm sure he's not going to get, like, an Emmy for the show, but he's... He puts in an interesting performance. He's not bad.
Yeah, I'm very excited. This will be fun.
Yeah.
All right.
So, Cobra Kai.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All right.
Good time this week. That was fun to do in person.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you next time. Sorry if it sounded weird, guys. Bye. Ugh. You're